One day after OpenLeaks test launch belatedly comes online, an OpenLeaks staffer at the Chaos Communication Camp, who has asked me not to name or even describe him, is giving a workshop on anonymous leaking in the group's sand-colored military tent. OpenLeaks' temporary headquarters has filled with a dozen hackers who are volunteering to probe a handful of willing WikiLeaks copycats for security flaws. StateLeaks, KHLeaks, FrenchLeaks, QuebecLeaks, and OpenLeaks itself, among others. The OpenLeaker is laying down some ground rules. Be responsible. Break, don't abuse, he says. And only test the sites we have the okay for. If you start hacking Cryptome or something, John Young will be pretty pissed at us. Then the hackers get to work. Each team of two assigned to audit a different site. Some music, the workshop leader offers, pacing around the room as they bury their heads in laptops. Death metal? He puts on an instrumental groove album instead. To my right sits Daniel Meredith, a developer recently hired by Al Jazeera to revamp the news network's own leaking site after its mockery by most of the computer security community. He's a solidly built blonde American, with cheeks tinged red by the summer sun of Qatar, the Arab Emirate where Al Jazeera has stationed him. Meredith has taken on the task of testing stateleaks.org, and he walks me through his reconnaissance. The audit starts simple. A search in the Whois database, which publicly tracks ownership of domain names. Domains can be registered with pseudonyms or anonymity services, but this one wasn't. It's registered to an organization called Geeks Paradox, and specifically to someone named Travis McCray. His phone number, email address, and postal address in Chivac, Alaska are all listed. If this guy is making an attempt to be anonymous, he's making a very shoddy attempt, says Meredith. The Al Jazeera developer runs a publicly available test from the computer security firm Qualys on the SSL setup of the site's submission system, and the result is a grade of C. The page doesn't use the latest version of SSL and allows weak encryption schemes. Next, Meredith runs Nmap and Firebug, two scanning tools that can help identify the software StateLeaks is using and vulnerabilities in its code. The server's visibility to these tools can be obscured with the right settings, but McCray hasn't bothered. He's running an Apache server application on the Linux operating system. At this point, Meredith says he would perform some timing analyses to see if the site is hosted on a single server or rotating among several computers for stability. But the camp's wireless connection likely isn't steady enough for the test, and he says he's already found plenty of loose ends to work with. At this point, I could probably take this information, run a simple exploit kit, and own his box, he says. Luckily, I'm a journalist, not a hacker. It's only then that Meredith takes the usual first step of a reporter and Googles Travis McCray. He immediately finds his MySpace page, complete with a photo of a very young, very sincere-looking, shaggy-haired boy in an ill-fitting black suit and a gold tie. That's him? Meredith asks himself. I'm getting the feeling we've been wasting our time looking at some teenager's website. When the hackers reconvene and start presenting their findings, StateLeaks is hardly the worst off. One site runs its public website on the same server as its submission system, opening it to attacks that could spill source data. One failed to load at all. They found flaws in OpenLeaks, too. The unprotected informational site at openleaks.org includes contact information without warning leakers not to send sensitive material to the group there. And the site's SSL setup is missing an intermediate certificate, part of the chain of signatures that certify that an encrypted site is not only scrambled, but comes from the source it appears to. The oversight might have let an imposter site posing as OpenLeaks lure and identify its leakers. After the copycat review, the OpenLeaker leading the session starts to ask tricky questions without easy answers. Should you advise leakers to upload from an internet cafe or even hand their encrypted data to someone else to upload? Is it acceptable to link your submissions page from a non-encrypted site, given that hacker tools like SSL Strip can remove a web page's encryption when the user clicks on it? Should you host a chat room on your site? Or does it merely open you to criminal accusations of soliciting leaks? Is Sweden a good country for hosting a submission site? Or does the 2009 law expanding the surveillance powers of the country's intelligence services mean leakers should move elsewhere? Everyone is saying that they have these secure submission systems, and it means nothing. We need some kind of public standard, he says. Right now, it's like the 1930s on airplanes, and everyone is smoking and partying, and there are no rules. When the workshop ends and the hackers file out, I approach the unnamed open leaker and ask why he didn't focus more on Tor and similar anonymity tools to protect whistleblowers. OpenLeaks' test site, I point out, even lets users upload documents without using its hidden service, potentially with none of Tor's multi-layered identity protection. The simple answer, he says, is that he doesn't believe Tor alone is enough. When you force people to use this tool, you put all your trust in it. If someone shows that the circuits are sniffed by the USA or something, it's broken, he says. You'll have advertised a totally broken system. Tor isn't the golden bullet of anonymity on the internet. So how does OpenLeaks plan to protect the identity of sources who don't have the savvy to use Tor or their own choice of proxy server? The OpenLeaker sighs, as if I've asked a question with a very long answer. Then he grabs a clubmate and sits down. WikiLeaks, he recaps, used cover traffic to mask which visitors were simply curious readers and which were leakers. A script on the site would run in their browser, uploading a randomly sized document. OpenLeaks will implement cover traffic too, he says. But implementing that tool on news organizations' websites won't be as easy, given that a visit to those sites' homepages would look different from visits to the leak submissions page. So they're planning on eventually integrating their submissions page directly into the homepages themselves, a trick that requires coaching their media partners on how to excise security bugs from the most complex portion of their sites. Once they have what the OpenLeaks engineer calls that armored car version of the partner sites set up, they plan to go even further than WikiLeaks, building more convincing cover traffic than has ever existed before, this unnamed engineer tells me. They've statistically modeled the timing and file size of uploads to WikiLeaks and have used it to spoof those submissions with high statistical accuracy. Most submissions to WikiLeaks were between 1.5 and 2 megabytes, for instance. Less than 1% are above 700 megabytes. Their cover traffic aims to follow exactly the same bell curve, making it theoretically indistinguishable from real submissions under the cover of SSL encryption, even when the user isn't running Tor. We have over 1.5 years of submissions data to analyze. That's something you can model. That's mathematics, he says. The more submissions we get, the better we model the cover traffic. It's a feedback loop. I ask how it is that he has access to 1.5 years of WikiLeaks submissions. And that's when the man I'm talking to explains to me, without preamble, that he is the architect. I'm paralyzed for a moment. Slowly it dawns on me that I've stumbled into the man at the technical center of the leaking movement, one whom I'd never expected to communicate with, let alone meet face to face. The architect, whether or not he notices my tongue-tiedness, speaks without pretension. He has a calm and patient authority. I launch into a long list of questions about his mysterious role in WikiLeaks and OpenLeaks, and he declines to answer most of them. He tells me nothing about his background, his career, beyond being a network engineer, or even his nationality. But there's one story he will tell: the events of his time at WikiLeaks and why he decided to leave. When the architect was first recruited by Dom Scheitberg, he says, WikiLeaks was essentially a pair of servers, one hosted at PRQ in Stockholm that redirected to another, more sensitive server in a data center somewhere else in Europe. If the authorities had gotten that box, that would have been it, he says. Game over. The architect demanded that the entire project be rethought and redesigned, which took the site offline for months. He didn't much like the group's organizational architecture either. He warned Berg that Assange had too much control of the project and that more of the financial and organizational responsibility should be shared. When Berg mentioned this to Assange, Assange accused Berg of plotting a power grab. "Julian warned me that Daniel was trying to control me," the architect says with a bitter laugh. "In fact, it was my idea." After the site's downtime in April 2010, the architect had most of WikiLeaks' materials ready to put back online and began pinging Assange to get the go-ahead to relaunch the site. But Assange was in Iceland, busy preparing the collateral murder video that would springboard WikiLeaks to stardom. The architect says that he didn't respond. The video went online while the site was still down, and Assange blamed the technical volunteers working with the architect for missing an important media opportunity, while the architect bristled at the insult. In July, when the group was preparing to publish the 76,000 files known as the Afghan War Diaries, the architect says he asked Assange to have the index for the release ready 2 weeks early. In the end, Assange left finishing the index page to the last minute, and it went up 4 hours late. "That was fine," the architect says calmly, "but I told him I wouldn't tolerate any more major fuck-ups." WikiLeaks had left 15,000 files unpublished that the group and its media partners at the New York Times, The Guardian, and Der Spiegel deemed too sensitive. Many contained the names of civilian informants to the U.S. military who might face reprisal if they were exposed. The architect says he recruited a group of 40 trusted volunteers to pore over the files to determine how they could be redacted and published. After 4 weeks of steady work, the files were edited and ready. Then the architect learned from Assange that he didn't in fact intend to publish those 15,000 documents and wanted to use the group's momentum with the media to publish the 392,000 Iraq documents instead. "So it was my job to tell all the guys that had spent 4 weeks reading shit for nothing," he says. The architect scrambled to work on a document organization system that the group could use for the Iraq files with double-blind reviews and redactions by volunteers. But instead, Assange simply redacted all names from the files with an automated program that deleted words based on their frequency, what the architect saw as sloppy over-redaction. By this time, Assange had already developed a deep distrust of Domscheit Berg and begun to see him as a threat and a rival. In fact, it was the architect, not Domscheit Berg, who was fomenting a mutiny, the architect says. He no longer believed Assange was responsible or careful enough to run the organization, IT resources, and finances, and told Domscheit Berg as much. The architect wasn't the only one turning against Assange. Reporters Without Borders and Amnesty International both issued open letters to Assange criticizing WikiLeaks for failing to more completely redact sources' names from the Afghan war diaries. Indiscriminately publishing 92,000 classified reports reflects a real problem of methodology and therefore of credibility, read the Reporters Without Borders statement. Journalistic work involves the selection of information. Even Birgitta Jonsdottir's allegiance with the group began to show cracks as WikiLeaks publications became larger and less discriminate. "We were very, very upset with the Afghan war release and with the way he spoke about it afterwards," Jonsdottir told the New York Times. "If he could just focus on the important things he does, it would be better." Domscheit Berg began to raise questions to Assange over instant messages about his lack of transparency as a leader and his singular control. Assange responded by accusing Domscheit Berg of making comments to a Newsweek reporter that Assange should be ousted from the group and demanded the German confess to his insubordinate statements. "If you do not answer the question, you will be removed," wrote Assange in an instant message to the German. "You are not anyone's king or god," snapped back Domscheit Berg. "And you're not even fulfilling your role as a leader right now. A leader communicates and cultivates trust in himself. You are doing the exact opposite. You behave like some kind of emperor or slave trader. You are suspended for 1 month, effective immediately," Assange responded. A few days later, Assange held a group meeting on an IRC chat room he called Mission First to discuss Domscheit Berg's behavior and lobby for his expulsion from WikiLeaks. It was just after the meeting that Domscheit Berg and the architect decided to stage a partial shutdown of the site. Just for a day, the architect, one of the few with access to the group's most sensitive infrastructure, took WikiLeaks' archive and homepage offline, a kind of strike to get the group's attention. Assange responded by shutting down WikiLeaks' domain name system entry, blacking out its submission system, email, and chat rooms in a digital game of chicken. The architect caved and turned the elements of the site he controlled back on. But he wanted nothing more to do with Assange. Domscheit Berg had worked on a similar system to what would become OpenLeaks as part of a failed grant proposal to the American nonprofit Knight Foundation. And the architect says he developed the idea further in a paper and sent it to Domscheit Berg, suggesting they leave WikiLeaks to work on it. The thing between Jay and Daniel is on a very personal level. But with me, it's simple. If you fuck with me, I fuck with you, he summarizes calmly. My work comes at a price. Not to be famous. I wanted to do something good. And if someone corrupts that, I'll pull the plug. Much of the hardware the site ran on belonged to the architect or Domscheit Berg, they say, and they had no intention of donating it to Assange's project. The architect says he gave the remaining WikiLeaks staffers 2 weeks to migrate their data off the servers they owned. A portion of the files were moved, but Assange had only tasked one developer to the operation. When the 2 weeks were up, that WikiLeaks volunteer had made little progress assembling a secure setup for the architect and Domscheit Berg to transfer the files. They gave Assange's developer another week. When that deadline passed too, the pair lost patience, so they simply changed the system's passwords and took control of all of it. The submission system, the archive of published documents, and the unpublished submissions collection of 3,000 leaked files. Why disembowel WikiLeaks so thoroughly on their way out? The architect and Domscheit Berg claimed that they didn't trust the group under Assange's leadership to properly protect the material, some of which they say contained data that was sent to Domscheit Berg personally and that might identify sources if it wasn't kept secure. For nearly 1 year between their departures from WikiLeaks and the Chaos Communication Camp, they kept the files encrypted and left them in the hands of a third party who didn't have the key. Best to give them to someone who doesn't even want the shit, says the architect. They had no plans to publish the files and said they'd offered to return them to WikiLeaks. But they claim Assange never offered a secure method of making the handoff. I didn't mind that Assange likes media attention or even the thing with the girls, the architect told me. But I don't believe he's able to handle the basic law that first, you protect the sources. Before the project, before any of the people in it. When John Young published a leaked excerpt of Domscheit Berg's book in January 2011 on Cryptome that revealed he and the architect had taken the unpublished submissions, Assange sent me a statement through Icelandic spokesperson Kristin Hrafnsson that described Domscheit Berg as an unethical, unstable charlatan. Domscheit Berg has falsely misrepresented himself in the press as a programmer, computer scientist, security expert, architect, editor, founder, director, and spokesman. He is not a founder or co-founder, and nor was there any contact with him during the founding years. He did not even have an email address with the organization until 2008. We launched in December 2006. He cannot program and wrote not a single program for the organization at any time. The statement didn't once mention the architect. When I spoke with that unnamed engineer 11 months after the rupture, WikiLeaks had neither gotten its unpublished submissions back from the open leakers, nor built a new submission system to replace the one that the architect and Domscheit Berg took with them. The architect says he has no regrets, either about dismantling WikiLeaks technology or cutting ties with Assange. WikiLeaks is like jumping from an airplane. It's for the adrenaline junkies, he says. At some point, you have to open the parachute. Some people open it earlier, some later. Some don't get the chance to open it at all. Only two men have been expelled from the Chaos Computer Club in its 30-year history. One was a Nazi. The other was Daniel Domscheit-Berk. On the third day of the Chaos Communication Camp, after OpenLeaks' fumbled launch, CCC board member Andy Mulla-Magun and three other club board members approached Domscheit-Berk at 3 a.m. outside a party a few tents away from OpenLeaks' encampment. They handed him a letter on the official CCC letterhead marked with a chaos knot, a bundle of tangled cables that served as the group's emblem. It explained that his membership had been revoked for damaging the reputation of the Chaos Computer Club through the public presentation of your talk on the project OpenLeaks, and creating the impression that the Chaos Communication Camp and its attendees had taken over a security check for your project and the source protection it promised. When Domscheit-Berk shows me that letter, it's the last day of camp, and he's pacing around the OpenLeaks tent, quickly and mechanically packing things away. "I don't need Andy Mulla-Magun to give us a permit for this project," he says angrily. "I don't fucking care." He stops for a moment and looks out of the tent flap as the first drops of rain began to fall from the dark sky over Finnefert. "If I had bothered about everything that everyone said about me since I left WikiLeaks, I would be living on a desert island right now." He walks back into the tent and asks in an agitated tone if there's any clubmate left. To Domscheit-Berk's visible relief, it turns out his young stepson had hidden a case under a table as a backup supply. As he opens a bottle, Domscheit-Berk explains what he believes is the real story behind his excommunication. Andy Mulla-Magun has been asked by Julian Assange to retrieve the submissions that he and the architect took from WikiLeaks. The fact that the OpenLeakers still haven't handed the materials over, as Domscheit-Berk tells it, is prejudicing the CCC's decision-making against him. And why exactly hasn't he handed those materials over to Mulla-Magun? The architect, who is sitting on a couch nearby, answers. "There's a network of trusted people who handle stuff," he says nonchalantly. "And he's not one of them. Besides, this is the guy who was already responsible for the biggest data handover fuck-up of all time," Domscheit-Berk adds. "He's not capable of anything serious." "What does that mean?" I ask the pair, confused. They decline to explain. "Just imagine the worst-case scenario you can think of," Domscheit-Berk offers after a moment. "And then add a little to it." After this foreboding statement, he walks out of the tent and into the rain, closing the flap behind him. The more secretive or unjust an organization is, the more leaks induce fear and paranoia in its leadership and planning coterie, Julian Assange wrote in his Conspiracy as Governance essay in 2006. 5 years later, that maxim wholly applied to WikiLeaks and Assange himself. The architect's and Domscheit-Berk's departure from the group with 3,000 unpublished submissions represented the first major breach of the organization's security. In the months that followed, the spillages continued. Rogue WikiLeaks partner Israel Shamir allegedly gave unredacted cables to the repressive government of Belarus, including information that may have been used against the Belarusian political opposition. The freelance journalist Heather Brook extracted a copy of the cables from the Icelandic WikiLeaker Smára McCarthy and passed them on to the Guardian newspaper, allowing the paper to publish the cables entirely without WikiLeaks' control and infuriating Assange. After the OpenLeaker's departure with WikiLeaks' submission system and files, Assange began contacting former WikiLeakers and other common associates to beg, cajole, and threaten them into helping him resolve what he called the hostage situation. By early 2011, Assange was publicly vowing to sue both The Guardian and Domscheit-Berk, lawsuits that never materialized. As his Nixonian anxiety grew, he went so far as to demand every WikiLeaks staffer sign a non-disclosure agreement that levied a $20 million fine for distributing a WikiLeaks document or even revealing the existence of the NDA itself. Inevitably, the contract itself leaked. When the document showed up on the New Statesman's website, Guardian reporter and former WikiLeaker James Ball admitted he was the source. WikiLeaks is not democratically accountable, Ball wrote in an editorial for the paper. It has no board or no oversight. If any organization in the world relies on whistleblowers to keep it honest, it is WikiLeaks. In such circumstances, silencing dissent is not just ironic, it's dangerous. Like the institutions Assange had once described as his targets, WikiLeaks was compromising its cause in an effort to contain its own employees' impulses to spill the organization's guts. And the biggest leak was yet to come. In retrospect, Andy Mulla Magun may not have been the ideal judge of whether the Chaos Computer Club should lend its support to WikiLeaks' most prominent spin-off group. Long before the CCC board member had expelled Domscheit Berg from the club, he already considered the German ex-WikiLeaker a traitor to hacker principles and a possible government informant. "I've been a member of the CCC for 26 years, he says as he picks at an arugula salad at an Italian restaurant near the hacker group's headquarters in Berlin. "Perhaps I've seen too many people's intelligence files." After WikiLeaks' 3 megaleaks and Domscheit Berg's departure from the group in late 2010, while the U.S. government was coiling into counterattack mode, Mulla Magun says Domscheit Berg began behaving strangely. He was so nervous when Mulla Magun ran into him around the Chaos Computer Club headquarters that the younger German's body shook and he couldn't complete a sentence, Mulla Magun recounts. After WikiLeaks and OpenLeaks split, Mulla Magun was tasked by Assange as mediator in the two groups' digital custody dispute. Around the same time, as the CCC board member tells it, Domscheit Berg seemed to suddenly and spontaneously regain his calm composure. Some people in the CCC believed that he made a deal that would ensure his safety from prosecution, Mulla Magun says knowingly. "I can't tell you what happened. Maybe I'm a conspiracy theorist, but I imagine this is true." And adopting this conspiracy theory, what does Mulla Magun think of OpenLeaks? "If we step back and look at this from very far away, from outer space," he says thoughtfully, "it looks like an intelligence agency's dream, to control the infrastructure itself. When I give Domscheit Berg a chance to respond to these accusations, he laughs and says again that he has never cooperated with intelligence agents. He reminds me of Assange's claim that government spies attended his wedding. In fact, Domscheit Berg says, the only person at the event with ties to intelligence agencies was Mulla Magun himself, whose crypto phone company sells to government customers. But regardless of their motives, as Mulla Magun tells the story, Domscheit Berg and the architect seemed determined to make the handover of WikiLeaks files as difficult as possible. Mulla Magun had been asked by Assange to retrieve 3 items from the OpenLeakers: the archive of already published documents, the submission system software, and the 3,000 unpublished leaks. The CCC president went after the submission system first, contacting the architect over encrypted chat. To his surprise, the architect immediately said he had no intention of giving back the submission system he had created under any circumstances. He called it his intellectual property, says Mulla Magun, pronouncing the two words with evident disgust. I couldn't believe it. To me, those were words from a different culture. That was the language of the enemy. The already published documents were more easily retrieved. Domscheit Berg sent them to Mulla Magun, and Mulla Magun relayed them to a WikiLeaks volunteer, who posted them in a downloadable format on WikiLeaks' Twitter feed so that they would be mirrored around the world and could never again be removed from the internet. But when Mulla Magun asked for the as-yet-unpublished files, WikiLeaks' 18-gigabyte collection of unrevealed secrets, Domscheit Berg and the architect seemed to respond with an endless stream of roadblocks and excuses. First, they said the files had been given to someone else and needed to be retrieved before they could be handed over. Then Domscheit Berg reconsidered and said he would need to sort out the files that were addressed specifically to him from those addressed to WikiLeaks at large. At each step, whichever of the two OpenLeakers Mullah Makun managed to contact would say that he needed more time to discuss with the other, further stalling the process. "My mood toward Daniel was changing," he says. "I was getting the feeling he was playing bullshit games. But there was nothing I could do." A few months into this game of tag, Domshad Berk committed what Mullah Makun considers a mortal sin against the unwritten hacker code. He published a tell-all book, one that detailed the group's warts and all history, and even included his bitter private chat logs with Assange. Why did he print internal chat protocols, private correspondence that had no context in philosophical or political disputes? Asks Mullah Makun. "I decided from that moment that my trust in Daniel must be reduced." At the Chaos Communication Camp, Mullah Makun was dismayed to see Domshad Berk touting a penetration test of his systems by the Chaos Computer Club, even as he declined to make the site's full code available. And then, when he asked one final time for the OpenLeakers to hand over WikiLeaks data, they gave him what he describes as an entirely new excuse: that WikiLeaks couldn't be trusted with any sensitive data, and that the pair owed it to sources to fully vet and redact the files before returning them. Mullah Makun called a meeting of the club's board at 10 p.m., and 5 hours later, the five members had unanimously decided to oust Domshad Berk from the group. Officially, the decision was based on OpenLeaks' abuse of the CCC's name at the camp. But for Mullah Makun, his anger toward Domshad Berk and the architect had been building for nearly a year. 11 months of diplomacy between OpenLeaks and WikiLeaks had ended in failure. A few days after the camp, Domshad Berk and the architect decided that there was no way they would ever give WikiLeaks back its files, and that there was no use in holding on to them and endangering sources. So they deleted their keys, rendering the files permanently, irrevocably encrypted. When the news emerged that the OpenLeakers had essentially destroyed 3,000 submissions, WikiLeaks sent out a stream of angry comments on Twitter, listing the contents of files it claimed were lost to history: internal communications of 20 neo-Nazi groups, 60,000 emails from the ultra-right-wing NPD party in Germany, a video of an airstrike in the Afghan town of Granai that allegedly killed 140 civilians, surveillance policies by over 100 internet companies, the entire U.S. no-fly list, and, most significantly to me, after a year of leakless waiting, 5 gigabytes of internal data from Bank of America. Domshad Berk later told me that WikiLeaks trumped up most of those claims. Of the files WikiLeaks listed, only the no-fly list was included in the encrypted cache and hadn't been published because it was already available elsewhere online. Sites like noflylist.com do offer some version of the list. The others, he says, had been stored by WikiLeaks elsewhere or didn't exist. Both he and the architect admitted the encrypted files did likely include some data from Icelandic financial institutions, but wouldn't provide details. As for the Bank of America files, Domshad Berk claims that WikiLeaks simply lost them, a victim of the site's mess of creaking servers and failing hard drives before its 2010 reorganization. Just what files became collateral damage in the dispute between WikiLeaks and OpenLeaks will likely never be completely known. Domshad Berk says he and the architect used the Department of Defense standard for data erasure for all existing copies of their secret keys, the most secure practice for eradicating information short of demolishing the hard drive that stores it. They wrote over the keys data 7 times with pseudo-random patterns to cover all possible forensic traces. In a few minutes, the 3,000 documents submitted by anonymous leakers to the world's most successful whistleblowing site over the course of 8 months, were permanently reduced to 18 gigabytes of chaos that would require longer than the history of civilization to decipher. By early 2011, WikiLeaks had experienced the full eviscerating effects of disgruntled insiders, From Domscheit Berg's book to Heather Brooks' transmission of the State Department cables to The Guardian to James Ball's leaked NDA contract. But WikiLeaks' most damaging leak would result from a more mundane phenomenon: simple human carelessness. When a WikiLeaks staffer received the archive of already published leaks recovered by Andy Mullah Magun at the end of 2010 and posted it online, the collection was uploaded to the Pirate Bay within days. What better outlet to prevent the next Domscheit Berg from undoing the group's work, after all, than that Swedish bastion of uncensorable file sharing? Now you can have your very own copy of the WikiLeaks archive. How cool is that? Wrote the unnamed user who first uploaded the document collection. Any curious visitor who downloaded the file might have noticed a strange folder among the CIA memos, Bilderberg meeting reports, lists of words banned from the internet by the Chinese government, and stolen emails from Sarah Palin's Yahoo account. It came last in alphabetical order and hardly attracted attention. It was called simply XYZ. Opening it revealed four files: X, Y, Y docs, and Z, each encrypted with PGP and thus unreadable. And they would have remained unreadable if it weren't for another simple mistake, this one committed by David Lee, the reporter from The Guardian who first engineered the partnership with WikiLeaks to release the Cablegate files. In January 2011, The Guardian's reporters published their own tell-all book about their work with WikiLeaks. And there, in the heading to the 11th chapter, were printed the words that to Julian Assange must have jumped off the page with horrifying significance: a collection of diplomatic history since _1966 _to the present day # / Julian Assange's 58-character password. It was the full passphrase to WikiLeaks' copy of the encrypted, unredacted cables. To a technological muggle like Lee, the PGP password must have seemed like a harmless historical detail to add intrigue to his cloak-and-dagger story. He later claimed that Assange had told him the password would soon be changed and saw no harm in publishing it a few months later. But to Assange and any other hacker, revealing a password represented a glaring security breach. Those familiar with PGP know that when a file is encrypted to a certain key, the private key will always open a copy of that encrypted file, and thus can never be revealed. Secret keys remain secret for life. This was no minor operational security slip-up. If someone curious about the archive's mysterious XYZ folder, and web forums of WikiLeaks watchers were already buzzing about the folder's mysterious contents, tried testing the printed password out on the four files, one by one, the result would be an incredible and terrible discovery. When he or she reached Z, the final file would open to reveal the entire unredacted set of State Department cables, complete with every sensitive source's name, from Chinese dissidents to African journalists, every innocent informant to the State Department and every repressive regime around the world. As Bradley Manning had described it, worldwide anarchy in CSV format. WikiLeaks had accidentally published an encrypted copy of the cables in a form that it couldn't unpublish. And now, The Guardian had published the key. For 6 months, the data breach was kept below the radar. If WikiLeaks was aware of its leak, it didn't comment on it. On file-sharing sites like the Pirate Bay and Torrent.net, it seemed that at least a few users had put together the password with the Z file, accessed the cables, and had noted the inclusion of the full cables in their description of the archive. Whether the cables were found and decrypted by foreign intelligence agencies, who might use the information for their own purposes, is less clear. One person, at any rate, was both well aware of WikiLeaks' cable breach and quite willing, it seemed, to talk about it: Daniel Domscheit Berg. In late summer of 2010, the small German newspaper Freitag, an OpenLeaks partner, published a story with the unassuming headline, "Leak at WikiLeaks." It was a peculiar article, making the shocking claim that WikiLeaks security had failed and that it had lost control of the entire cable database, but carefully leaving out all details that might help someone find or decrypt it. It was, nonetheless, the only hint that the internet needed. Soon, Twitter users were making the connections between the printed password and the XYZ folder. Finally, it was John Young, the spiritual godfather of online leaking, who helpfully decrypted the entire database and posted it, entirely unredacted, to Cryptome. Mediation of this disclosure is not needed in a democracy, he explained in his Twitter feed. That the unreconfigured cables have become public is to be applauded and not condemned. WikiLeaks found itself in the embarrassing position of holding back portions of files that anyone could already read online. So it soon followed Cryptome's lead and published in unredacted form the remainder of the 250,000 cables it hadn't yet released. The meta leak was complete. Then the recriminations began. WikiLeaks blamed The Guardian for having negligently published the password. The Guardian's David Lee pointed the finger at WikiLeaks for having published the encrypted file, even insinuating that Assange had wanted the full cables published all along and had purposefully tricked Lee into printing the password so that the fiasco could be blamed on him. In fact, it was Domscheit Berg who, advertently or not, had caused WikiLeaks' leak to be sprayed across the internet. He later told me that it was indeed he who tipped off Stefan Kraft, the editor at Freitag, who publicized the breach. Domscheit Berg claims that he had long known about the cable spillage and believed it demonstrated exactly why he and the architect couldn't safely return WikiLeaks' unpublished submissions. As for Andy Mulla-Magun, Domscheit Berg blamed him for having uploaded the archive file to the web, what he had elliptically described to me at the camp as the biggest data handover fuck-up of all time. Mulla-Magun denies any role in uploading the file. I've been shutting up about this for months. I've been taking all the blame and all the heat from people who say my concerns for WikiLeaks operation security are just made up, that I'm just a liar, that I'm trying to make them look bad because I'm not giving anyone proof, he says. So I pick up one reporter that I trust at Freitag and told him the detail so he could verify I had a concern. I didn't want him to spread the story. That was his choice. I'm not interested in these cables leaking at all. It's completely irresponsible, and it's not the consequence of what I've done. By alerting the mainstream media, hadn't he screamed into a megaphone a secret that until then had only been whispered around the web? You think that would have gone on forever? He asks angrily. It was only a matter of time until one and one were put together. If that's not communicated publicly, then the people implicated in the cables will never find out they need to be careful. That was the most important thing. Domscheit Berg wasn't alone in thinking that the covers of the State Department's informants were already blown. P.J. Crowley, the former spokesperson for the State Department who had resigned after criticizing the military's treatment of Bradley Manning, commented that any autocratic secret service worth its salt had already accessed the cables. Nonetheless, after the Freitag story, new damage from the leak was already beginning to surface. Two Zimbabwean generals whose names had been marked strictly protected in the cables had met secretly with State Department officials to criticize the leader of the country's armed forces, calling him an inexperienced leader in the sway of corrupt President Robert Mugabe's political party. With their names exposed, they faced a possible court-martial on charges of treason. The names of Chinese dissidents exposed in the leak were passed around on nationalist web forums, with some calling for manhunts and violence against them. Nine Iraqi Jews in Baghdad, who were named in the cables, were advised by the U.S. Embassy and the Iraqi Anglican Church to leave the country for fear of violent reprisal. After one Ethiopian journalist who communicated with the embassy in Addis Ababa was exposed as having met with a confidential informant in the government's communication office, he was interrogated by officials who gave him 24 hours to reveal his source. Instead, he fled to Uganda It's very sad. Within a week, leaving your home without any preparation, he told the BBC. I love my country, and I love my job, and it's a big loss for me. WikiLeaks, to be fair, had never promised its sources it would redact or edit the information it received from them, only that it would maximize that information's impact. It hadn't vowed to protect the people mentioned in its leak, but rather the identity of the leaker himself, a promise the group has never violated. But when that mission came up against the practical, humanitarian necessity of keeping some secrets secret while revealing others, WikiLeaks had tried to resist the natural tendency of all shared information to leak. And when it inevitably failed to control that tendency, it put at risk some of the very truth-tellers and whistleblowers it had sought to empower. The secret-killing machine had turned upon itself. 55 miles north of Berlin, on the north edge of a group of picturesque lakes, stands a cluster of single-story buildings inside a brick-walled compound, the remains of the Ravensbrück Nazi concentration camp. From 1939 to 1945, the all-female camp imprisoned more than 130,000 women from across Europe. Jews, gypsies, lesbians, political activists, resistance fighters, and a small contingent of children who had been in the victims' care when they were captured. More than 100,000 women of all ages were gassed, shot, lethally injected, buried alive, murdered in inhuman medical experiments, or marched to death as their captors moved them westward to hide from the invading Soviet army. Almost all of the children died from starvation. Most of the victims' remains are buried in a mass grave covered in stones facing a lake that contains the ashes of thousands of cremated bodies. Across that body of water, just 2 miles away, inside a white three-story house in a sleepy German town that he asks me not to name, Daniel Domscheit-Berg invites me into his home and the future headquarters of OpenLeaks. Domscheit-Berg didn't intend to move his family and his organization next to the site of one of the 20th century's darkest atrocities, he explains as he shows me around the house. But he got a very good deal on the property. The OpenLeaks founder's office on the ground floor is strewn with random computer paraphernalia. Unused servers are stacked waist high in the corner. Near his desk lies an enormous 160-watt megaphone he recently used in a protest against European Union data retention laws. A length of 4-inch diameter copper cabling that he took as a souvenir from his high school summer job laying electrical lines rests at the foot of a couch. He recently purchased a 4-foot-tall, 1,400-pound steel safe he plans to install in the basement to hold his family's and OpenLeaks' most sensitive files. Despite the maelstrom of anger and blame swirling around the test launch of OpenLeaks, the irretrievably lost WikiLeaks submissions, and the leak of the unredacted cables, Domscheit-Berg seems utterly relaxed, sitting with me and munching on an apple from the century-old tree in his backyard. We felt like Frodo in Lord of the Rings, he says of the files he and the architect scuppered. People kept finding reasons why we should give them the data. In the end, we knew we had to destroy it. And since we did, life is good. I'd rather take the shitstorm and be everyone's scapegoat than go against my best knowledge and risk compromising sources. 5 months after this meeting, and half a year after Domscheit-Berg's expulsion from the Chaos Computer Club, his hacker credibility would be partially redeemed. A special meeting of the group in February 2012 reinstated Domscheit-Berg's membership, and Andy Mulla-Magun lost his board position in a reproach of his hasty and biased decision to expel the open leaker. We decided that if we evicted people based only on suspicions and doubt, it would become very easy to destroy us with rumors, one CCC member later told me. But at the time of my meeting Domscheit-Berg in his home, his reputation among his hacktivist cohorts has reached a nadir. I ask the obvious question. Doesn't his role in WikiLeaks setbacks and crises bode ill for the future of OpenLeaks? When even many of his fellow hackers see him as a traitor, how does he expect leakers to trust him? If this depends only on my reputation, it won't work anyway, he responds calmly. We can only do this by proving the technology works and slowly building up trust. Dom Scheidberg seems to be in a chatty mood. We talk about his plan to turn the third floor of this house into a workshop for activists, about the concentration camp across the lake, and then about Dom Scheidberg's early obsession with World War II and the Holocaust. As the conversation meanders, he brings up the White Rose Movement, a resistance group that attempted to distribute underground newspapers during the Nazi era, and we discuss whether WikiLeaks-style megaleaks might have prevented Hitler's rise to power. Sitting so geographically close to the site of so many Nazi atrocities that remained secret for far too long, the question hangs in the air. Dom Scheidberg admits it's probably impossible to answer. Instead, he brings up a German-language book he recently read titled Soldiers, co-written by two professors who gained access to 150,000 pages of transcribed, secret recordings made of German prisoners of war in British and American camps. Dom Scheidberg was fascinated by the cavalier way the soldiers discussed killing civilians and raping women with professional dispassion in the book's pages. The last chapter deals with WikiLeaks' collateral murder video, with its American helicopter gunners firing on Iraqi civilians as if in a video game. Both wars' recordings demonstrate the quintessential act of leaking, Dom Scheidberg says. They take an immoral act out of some special secret culture where it seems acceptable and expose it to the world of normal human relationships where it's exposed as obviously horrific. Within a certain frame of reference, what they're doing seems professional or even cool, he says. But if you get rid of that secrecy, it seems crazy. If you make it all transparent, their own mothers would call them and ask, "What the hell are you doing? That's not how I raised you." Just as Dom Scheidberg is articulating that ultimate definition of a leak's value, he receives a phone call and has a tense German conversation. He tells me he needs to get to Berlin. On the train a few minutes later, I ask him if he hopes OpenLeaks will spill entire wars' histories and huge caches of diplomatic documents the way WikiLeaks has. He initially dodges the question, saying that the decision would fall to the group's media partners. But after a pause, he answers. "That stuff isn't going to happen again," he says, looking at the German countryside rolling by. Bradley Manning's treatment and improved government security measures, he believes, have scared off any near-term mega-leakers of high-level government secrets on the scale of the WikiLeaks 2010 releases. But that doesn't mean some sort of mega-leak isn't in the works, he warns. Some leak will very harshly damage people's privacy. Some large amount of healthcare data, perhaps. Something where the whole world will agree that it never should have happened. It all sounds like a very dark vision for a transparency advocate, I point out, and one that's very different from that of Julian Assange. He nods. Julian wrote this really lame piece of philosophy in 2006, he continues, referring to the conspiracy as governance essay. He sees everything as a conspiracy that must be taken down. I don't see the world in these black and white terms. I think there's a valid reason for some things to be secret. You can't solve the entire Middle East's problems in public. So what should be secret then? Every situation is different, he answers. Drawing the line is the toughest question in this field. I can forgive Dom Scheidberg for his reluctance to answer the impossible questions of the leaking movement. Unlike Assange, he is, and has only claimed to be, an engineer, not a philosopher. And for an engineer, things were clearer before 2010, during the period when WikiLeaks was engaged in smaller, targeted, high-frequency leaking. Before the megaleaks, the redactions, the risk of leaked leaks, the need to sort out good secrets from bad on a massive, terrifying scale. Back when WikiLeaks was, for the most part, two idealistic young men exposing wrongdoing from a steadier moral high ground. As we arrive in Berlin, I ask him if he has any message he'd like me to pass on to Assange, given that the two haven't spoken in nearly a year. I guess tell him to stop lying about me, he says quickly. That's the least I can ask from someone who talks about telling the truth so much. And then he thinks for a moment and brightens slightly, as if he's remembering a different person altogether, and another time. And also, tell him good luck.